When was the last time you were at a small gig? As we know, live local music venues are having it tough right now, where donations from the musicians themselves seem to be the only thing keeping them afloat. Dr. Sam Whiting, Senior Research Fellow in Music Industries at RMIT University, joins us this morning to explore this issue further. Thanks for joining us, Sam. How are you this morning?
Good. Thanks for having me, Cameron.
No worries. So what did Amel and the Sniffers do recently that epitomised this issue live music venues are facing?
Yeah, so unfortunately their gig at Federation Square in Melbourne was cancelled due to crowd safety issues. And so they donated their performance fee across, I think it was 7 small grassroots venues in Melbourne, and they put $5,000 in the bar for each of those venues, and they told their fan base to go and spend the night at those venues having a free drink on them. So very gracious and very community-oriented gesture, kind of giving back to the venues that nurtured them when they were coming up in the Melbourne scene.
So why exactly are grassroots music venues struggling, and when did this struggle start?
Well, I would say grassroots music venues have been doing it tough since the turn of the century. When certainly in Sydney, you'd be familiar with the battles against the pokies and lockout laws. But, you know, these venues have never really turned a significant profit since maybe the heydays of the 80s and 90s when people were drinking a lot more and overheads were lower, inner city rent was lower. But since COVID and the pandemic, pressures have gotten significantly more intense. So on the supply side, you know, inflation's been a real problem, and public liability insurance has skyrocketed. You know, the way we assess risk and insurance costs in this country is prohibitively expensive. And then on the demand side, people are drinking a lot less, and most of our grassroots music venues are highly reliant on alcohol sales to drive revenue. There's also been demand flight to bigger events. So people are going to more arena and large stadium shows and less small to medium gigs. So, yeah, there's been a lot of change in the sort of small to medium part of the live music sector.
Now, less alcohol consumption is definitely a worldwide ish phenomenon as well. So places like Northern Europe, France and UK have a way to support these alcohol-based commercial models. So what are they doing over in those countries that are helping to support alcohol-based commercial models like small live music venues?
Yeah, so I've actually just completed the Churchill Fellowship, where I spent 100 days interviewing 100 different people across and venue operators across the UK and Europe, trying to get to the bottom of what are different ways of supporting grassroots music activity and what are different venue ownership and operating models. So in Northern Europe and France, they kind of treat these spaces more like cultural public institutions. So what you have is a lot of independent, not-for-profit organizations like a foundation, associations that have a professional team but also involve volunteers. And those organizations are usually subsidized by local government through a combination of things like cheap rent. They might be using a building that's owned by the local government, subsidized energy and other overheads. So they're really treated in those parts of Europe more like, you know, our libraries and other community infrastructure that's funded by local government. Whereas in the UK, which is more similar to the Australian market, in which live music has been treated as a commercial product, there's been a broad acknowledgement across the sector that venues of a certain size, say 400 capacity or less, there's been a broad acknowledgement that those venues don't turn a profit. And so increasingly, venues of that size are moving towards not-for-profit models. And there's a specific legal form in the UK called a community interest company. And it looks and smells like a commercial firm. You don't have to change your business model, but it's a registered not-for-profit. It can receive tax exemptions and other forms of public funding that commercial companies can't. And so that's been adopted more and more. The UK Music Venue Trust has been encouraging venues to incorporate venues as community interest companies. And there's all sorts of other initiatives happening abroad to kind of mitigate the effects of the changing sector and a reduced, you know, and encourage a reduced reliance on alcohol consumption.
And would these European strategies work in Australia, or are there other strategies that, that would work better for the Australian context?
That's a great question. So the way I see it is there's two problems for Australian music venues. There's security of tenure, so knowing you'll be operating in that building long-term, so having a long-term lease that's affordable, having a good relationship with your landlord. And unfortunately, private landlords don't really care about live music. There's a lot of pubs and great venues around our, this country that are owned by, you know, sort of maybe a foreign investor, and they might want to develop that site or sell it off. We've seen this with the Crown and Acre Hotel in Adelaide and the Curtin Hotel in Melbourne. And so there's not really anything stopping them. So what we need to do is find ways of safeguarding the actual buildings that venues are operating out of. One way to do that is get local government involved. There are some great venues. I used to live in Adelaide, in Adelaide, that are venues that are owned by local and state government, and not run by those governments, but, you know, leased to venue operators. The other thing that's really exciting that I've seen in the UK is collectively owned venues that are financed through community shares. So basically, a whole bunch of people who care about live music have pooled their money, and there's an organisation called Music Venue Properties that's used that funding to buy the buildings that venues are operating out of. And basically, all of those people who've invested collectively own those venues. So they've socialised music venues, which I think is pretty cool. And then the other problem I see is financial sustainability. You know, we have a commercial model for small venues in Australia that I think is maybe not fit for purpose anymore. So a really exciting initiative are venues that are becoming registered charities. Lazy Thinking in Dulwich Hill is in the process of becoming a DGR1 registered charity, which means you'll be able to make tax-deductible donations to that organisation. And there are other sort of initiatives that, I guess, take the model away from a commercially oriented model. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be earning money as a venue operator, and it doesn't mean you're not still going to be selling alcohol, but it kind of changes community's relationship with the venue. It makes them, if you're a registered not-for-profit, you know, you'd be eligible for less income tax paid on wages and salaries. You'd be more eligible for public funding. You'd be more eligible for tax-deductible donations. So it's all about kind of reorienting small venues away from a sort of profiteering model, not that they make a lot of profit, and more towards a community, the sort of community role that we already know that they play in our music scenes, and creating and encouraging legal forms that make the best use of what the way that they already operate, you know, as social hubs for music scenes and as platforms for emerging talent.
And I guess my last question for you, Sam, is, you know, in the current model of how things are right now, people can obviously go out and go to live music events to support these venues, but where can people find out what's going on in their local area in terms of live gigs in small venues?
That's a good question. I think there is a lack of a centralized gig guide. Certainly here in Melbourne, Beat Magazine still operate an online gig guide that's pretty up to date, but most of the time you have to go directly to venues, websites, or Instagrams to find them. I'm not sure what the situation is like in Sydney. Where do you have a centralised gig guide in Sydney people can refer to?
Yeah, we do have sydneymusic.net, which is Sydney's most comprehensive gig guide. I'm not sure if it still happens on Breakfast, but we used to have the guy from Gig Guide come in and have a chat. But no, there are ways people can go online and see what's going on. So Sydney Music, we'll link those all for Melbourne and Sydney, and we'll link those on the website when this interview goes up. But yeah, we do have a Gig Guide here in Sydney too, so it's a good thing to have a scroll through.
Yeah, I guess the thing I would add is that it is unfortunate that the only way we can really support these venues is going and drinking in them. I think that what I'm advocating for is other ways through which we can support grassroots music activities. Apart from buying alcohol, I'm definitely in favour of having a beer, but I think we need other ways to support these venues and make them more sustainable in the long term.
Absolutely. Dr. Sam Whiting, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Sam Whiting, Senior Research Fellow in Music Industries at RMIT University, explaining why live music venues are struggling and what can be done about it.